Hey, everybody. Welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer here. This week, we've got great stories about animals and the environment. A new study about bears in hibernation finds that they're metabolic marvels, and a population of fish in rivers in New York and New Jersey didn't die when hundreds of thousands of pounds of industrial pollutants were dumped into the water. They actually evolved. And we've got a story about some strong storms linked to global warming. But first this week, we'll turn to the world of computer science. Back in 1997, IBM's Deep Blue supercomputer bested world chess champion Garry Kasparov. Well, this week brought a new contest between another IBM computing system and the two most celebrated contestants from the TV quiz show Jeopardy.
These Jeopardy champions are so smart, people say their brains are like computers. This new IBM computer is so smart, they say its brain is almost human.
At Jeopardy, we say, let the games begin.
The heavily promoted games were played earlier this week. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports why this machine is a formidable competitor, even though it doesn't think exactly like a human. And don't worry, if you haven't seen them yet, we won't spoil the result.
When Deep Blue demolished humans at chess, people could dismiss its victories, saying the game really is just math, perfect for a computer. Oren Etzioni is a computer science professor at the University of Washington in Seattle.
People said, okay, that's amazing, but ultimately, look, this is chess. This is something that's very precise. It's very constrained, right? Black and white, if you will.
Chess didn't involve anything really quirky or fuzzy or ambiguous. Nothing really human.
This is Jeopardy!
Now, Jeopardy, on the other hand, is a game full of tricky wordplay. The clues contain little jokes, puns, hidden meanings, the kind of human language that has traditionally baffled literal-minded computers. That's what made Jeopardy such an enticing challenge for IBM. About two dozen researchers spent 4 years building a computer system called Watson. Last month, it squared off in a short practice round against the two top Jeopardy champions, Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter. The two men stood behind podiums in front of a big Jeopardy board. Between them was a black rectangular computer screen. Watson hit the buzzer again and again.
Watson?
Who is Mary Leakey?
You're right.
800, same category.
Harriet Boyd Haas was the first woman to discover and excavate a Minoan settlement on this island. Watson.
What is Crete?
Yes.
Let's finish Chicks Dig Me.
Chicks Dig Me. That was the category name. The questions were about women and archaeology. David Ferrucci leads the team that made Watson. He says, never mind figuring out the answer. The game's first hurdle is figuring out the question.
I mean, the computer has to find out, you know, where are the individual words? And then how do the words group together? You know, what's the verb? What's the subject? What's the object? What's the preposition? What's the object of the preposition?
He says even after doing that, Watson still doesn't understand a word's meaning like we do. Humans have real-world experience. We know chicks. We've been to islands.
When we hear language, we bring so much context to interpreting the question that we come up with sensible and reasonable answers. The computer struggles with that.
To aid in this struggle, Watson's creators gave it awesome speed and memory. It searches through some 200 million pages of reference material, everything from the Bible to encyclopedias to novels, looking for the words or phrases in the Jeopardy clue and seeing what other words are frequently associated with them on those pages. This produces lots of potential answers. But which one is likely to be correct?
And so it reads other things and says, does this passage support this as the answer?
Watson knows how to weigh all this evidence because it knows the game. It studied thousands of Jeopardy clues plus their correct solutions. In mere seconds, Watson comes up with a list of possible answers and ranks them. The top choice is the one it has the most confidence in.
And if that confidence is above a threshold, it says, oh, I want to buzz in.
Watson?
Who is Tennyson?
Yes, Alfred Lord Tennyson.
Watson can make mistakes. Ferrucci says the errors can be funny and revealing.
You know, one of my favorites is, you know, what do grasshoppers eat? And then it came back and said kosher.
How do you think it got that answer?
It turns out grasshoppers is an actual kosher food.
Experts say that even with the occasional mistake, Watson has what it takes to perform very well against humanity's best. Oren Etzioni expects to see a Watson win.
Does that mean that it's game over for humans, that robots will keep us as pets? Absolutely not. But it does mean it's a demonstration that we've significantly expanded the envelope of what computers can really achieve.
The contest will be broadcast over 3 nights, starting this evening. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
There are some advantages to being a bear. One is you get to sleep through the winter, but there are some other perks you might not know about. NPR's Joe Palca has the bear facts.
It's relatively easy to study small creatures, especially the ones you can grow in the lab. But Brian Barnes wants to study bears, in particular, hibernating bears.
And we wanted it in natural conditions. And so these were the challenges.
Did you go to them or did they come to you?
They came to us.
Their supply of bears comes from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. They're typically bears who've taken a wrong turn and wound up in the middle of a city, like Anchorage. In the summer, the bears live outdoors at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, where Barnes works.
And then we move them into a hibernaculum.
Hibernaculum. Is that a real word or did
it
you
is.
Have to make one up?
And the plural's hibernacula.
In this case, it's basically a big box, wired so it can measure things like the bear's temperature, heart rate, or brain waves.
We anticipated they might just tear the place up or go on strike or something, but they actually showed very natural behavior of getting ready to hibernate.
As you can see on our website, when they start to hibernate, they curl up.
They go to sleep. They begin to quiet their heart rate, slow their breathing, and their metabolic rate plunges.
Barnes says the study he and his colleagues are publishing today in the journal Science marks the first time bears have been monitored throughout the winter. So what happens when hibernation starts?
The bear will cool off just by a few degrees.
From a normal temperature of about 99 degrees down to about 90 degrees.
And yet its metabolic rate decreased by 75%.
This was a surprise. No one realized that a bear could stay so warm while lowering its metabolism that much. It's a combination of very good insulation accompanied by bouts of shivering when the bear's internal temperature drops much below 90. Barnes says just about everything a bear does while hibernating is remarkable.
Bears don't eat, drink, urinate, or defecate for 6 or 7 months.
They make their own water, probably by metabolizing fat, and they get rid of wastes by breaking them down internally.
They're a closed system. All they need is air, and they can do just fine. They're a metabolic marvel.
One of the things bears do with waste is to use the calcium in it to keep their bones strong. A human who is bedridden for months will start to lose bone mass. But Seth Donahue says his research shows that doesn't happen with bears. Donahue is at the Michigan Technical University.
Basically, we found that there were no negative consequences of 6 months of hibernation on the bone strength or mineral content.
And it's not just the bones in bears that stays strong throughout the winter.
They have this neat capacity to conserve their muscle mass as well as muscle strength.
Hank Harlow is at the University of Wyoming. Preserving muscle size and strength is also pretty remarkable. Human muscles will shrink if they aren't used regularly. Harlow says it would be a boon to medicine if scientists could figure out how a bear keeps that from happening. Craig Heller from Stanford University is an author on the new bear paper. He says for people bedridden for long periods, or people who are contemplating a long space voyage, such as going to Mars and back, figuring out how to make a human more like a hibernating bear would have some advantages.
One would be lowering the energy requirements, so you don't need as much food and water and resources. But another is just reducing the boredom.
Of course, making an astronaut more like a hibernating bear won't solve all the problems of a long space voyage. A renegade computer could still cause trouble.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Scientists have discovered a strange fish that lives in a soup of some of industry's worst pollutants. The fish are found in rivers in New York and New Jersey. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, it turns out that the fish can survive because they've evolved to cope with dangerous chemicals.
From Godzilla to the Toxic Avenger, film and television have run with the idea that radiation or toxic waste can create weird new species. Just take it from Leela, the one-eyed mutant girl dreamt up by The Simpsons creator Matt Groening in the cartoon series Futurama.
Look at that lake! One dip in that toxic muck and your DNA will be permanently mutated. Jump in and go for a swim.
In New York and New Jersey, it's not a lake full of toxic muck, but the Hudson and nearby rivers. The weird fish in question are called tomcod. They look like a regular cod, but smaller. These tomcod are up to their eyeballs in dangerous chemicals, PCBs and dioxins that General Electric companies dumped into the Hudson from 1947 to 1976. By the 1980s, about 95% of those fish in some areas had liver tumors. But toxicologist Isaac Wiergen at New York University found that some populations of the exposed fish were doing okay.
It turns out that the more we were dealing with these things, it became apparent that they actually were very resistant to PCB and dioxin.
Here's what had happened. In some fish, pollutants entered the nucleus of cells, where they distorted the DNA instructions from one particular gene. The fish got sick. But some tomcod, just by chance, had a version of that gene that tolerates PCBs and dioxin. So over time, fish with the resistant gene did better than fish without it, and pretty much took over. Technically, they're not mutants. The chemicals just gave one genetic group an advantage over the rest. So some survived. But Wiergen says there's a downside to that.
Normally, these levels of PCBs or dioxins would kill these types of organisms, but here they survive, and they're prime prey.
Prey for bigger fish, which absorb the pollutants in the tomcods and pass them up to whatever or whoever eats them. The research appears in the journal Science, and a toxicologist who studies fish says it makes an important point.
That pollution had driven evolution.
That's Richard DiGiulio at Duke University. He says it's happened in North Carolina, too, with something called killifish. They evolved resistance to another pollutant, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, from wood preservatives that seeped into the Elizabeth River. DiGiulio points out another drawback to the evolution of chemical hardiness.
While they have evolved resistance to the pollution, they have lost some ability to cope with natural stressors.
Stressors like low oxygen in the water or abnormally high water temperatures. So, survivors these peculiar fish may be, but a success story they are not. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Scientists have been saying for years that as the planet heats up, we will have to deal with more severe weather. But pinning any particular event, such as a specific hurricane, to global warming is difficult at best. Now, scientists have tried to do just that. They've linked extreme precipitation to global warming. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Here's the thing about climate change. Miles Allen at Oxford University says it's hard to feel the effects of a slowly warming planet.
One of the problems I think many people find with climate change is it's sort of a victimless crime in the sense that the impacts are largely hypothetical for many people.
But climate change isn't just about a gradual temperature rise. Many studies forecast more extreme weather, like stronger hurricanes and bigger downpours. Even so, Allen told a press briefing it's hard to look back at something like Hurricane Katrina or Europe's devastating heat wave of 2003 and say that it was the result of global warming.
It is a reasonable question, you know, is human influence on climate anything to do with this nasty bit of weather we're having? But answering it isn't easy.
Allen and his colleagues have just taken a stab at it. They focused on some major flooding in England and Wales back in the fall of 2000. NPR's Julie McCarthy covered the record-shattering deluge.
With rain lashing the west, freak tornadoes struck the south, and blizzards swept the north to Scotland.
The question is, would this have happened in the absence of the global warming we've experienced to date? To find out, Allen's colleague Pardeep Paul at Oxford explains they ran thousands of computer simulations of the climate on thousands of computers. They compared simulated worlds with and without global warming.
To do that repetition, those thousands of repetitions would have been pretty tough to do all by ourselves. So we actually asked members of the public across the world to run our simulations for us on their own personal computers using their idle time. And this was done via the climateprediction.net project.
And they report in Nature that the extreme rainfall was far more likely to appear in the computer simulations of our current climate than in a world without global warming. so they're fairly confident in saying that the flooding was linked to global warming. Allen says the excessive rainfall is pretty simple to explain.
It's largely driven by the fact that the air is just warmer and therefore holding more water.
Now, this particular experiment took a huge amount of computing power, so it's not something that climate scientists can do routinely. But Allen hopes the day will come when analysis like this will become routine after major events.
It won't be enough for your weather service to predict the weather. They'll have to explain it as well.
And Allen hastens to add that not all extreme weather events can be blamed on climate change. The world has always had bad weather, and it will keep having bad weather. Now, a second study in Nature asks a much broader question, and that is whether the worst downpours are getting even more extreme over time. Author Francis Weirs from the Pacific Climate Impacts Consortium in British Columbia says yes.
Extreme precipitation events today are generally a fair bit larger than they were in the 1950s and 60s.
And he attributes at least some of that increase to humans warming the planet. Some scientists not involved in these studies find them provocative, but not convincing. Here's Carrie Emanuel from MIT.
I think it's going to be very tough ever to do individual events. The only exception are events that are so extreme that they couldn't have occurred in the current climate, but proving that is difficult.
The trend is clearly toward a warmer world with more severe weather, but it's still going to be hard to blame humans for any single disaster. Richard Harris, NPR News.
I look out my window and what do I see? Raindrops, raindrops, they mark the pathway to my destiny. Raindrops, raindrops.
Scientists have discovered a group of people with a rare gene mutation that protects them from cancer and diabetes. The mutation also keeps them from growing taller than a typical third grader. Researchers say the discovery could lead to new ways of preventing deadly diseases associated with aging. NPR's John Hamilton reports on the finding and the unlikely scientific journey that led to it.
The journey began more than 15 years ago in a lab in Los Angeles. A graduate student named Walter Longo was studying yeast. He was hoping to learn something that might help humans live longer, healthier lives. Longo, who is now a professor at USC, says his research led him first to a particular type of genetic mutation. Ultimately, it took him to the mountains of southern Ecuador to study people with something called Laronde syndrome.
They're very short. They're most of them less than 4 feet tall. And they're generally normal. Some of them have families, and they seem to be pretty happy, very intelligent, just small, yes.
Longo says another scientist had noticed something surprising about these people. They didn't seem to get diseases associated with aging.
Even though they have increased obesity, none of them have ever developed diabetes.
And when Longo and a team of researchers studied decades of medical records on 99 of these people, they found that only one got cancer. That was a much lower rate of cancer than among their taller relatives. The team thought this protection might come from the same gene mutation that made these people so small. It's a mutation that keeps cells from responding to growth hormone. Longo knew that a similar mutation greatly extends the lifespans of yeasts and worms and rodents, and he had suspected that it might work that way in people, too.
There was only one major piece missing, which was the human data, and this is it, you know.
Longo says the mutation seems to prevent diabetes by allowing people to get by on very low levels of insulin. It wards off cancer by reducing DNA damage in cells and helping to eliminate abnormal cells. Longo says you'd expect all this protection to allow the small people in Ecuador to live longer than their taller relatives. They don't.
The majority of them die of just strange causes, including alcohol-related deaths, accidents, etc.,
things that have nothing to do with disease. Subtract the preventable deaths, Longo says, and it looks like they really would live longer than their relatives. Longo says his study is good news. He says a whole lot of people might be able to lower their risk of cancer and diabetes if they could lower their levels of growth hormone. Roberto Salvatore of Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore agrees. He studied a group of small people in northeast Brazil whose bodies don't produce growth hormone at all. He says they also appear less susceptible to diseases associated with aging. Salvatore says people taking growth hormone for medical reasons shouldn't be concerned by the new study. For example, he says there's good scientific evidence that children who are prescribed growth hormone to reach normal height are not at increased risk of cancer.
So I think that, you know, parents should not worry too much about this.
But Salvatore says athletes or others who are taking large doses of growth hormone to build muscle should take the new study as a warning.
If lacking growth hormone is associated with lack of cancer, one could sort of assume that excessive growth hormone may be associated with increased cancer. So, you know, it's certainly a worry.
The new research appears in the journal Science Translational Medicine. John Hamilton, NPR News.
That's all for this week's Science Podcast from NPR. We've got a new website, npr.org/sciencepodcast, where you can find all the stories you heard here today. That's npr.org/sciencepodcast. And remember, shoot us an email at sciencepodcast@npr.org and let us know what you'd like to hear. I'm Andrew Prince. Have a great week.